Welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Peter Hunter. Hi, Peter.
Hi there, Adrian.
So, Peter, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a bit about you and the work that you do?
My history is a bit odd in that, well, perhaps traditional in that I actually ran away to sea when I was 16. And I was away for about 6 years, became a navigator in the Merchant Navy. Then the British Merchant Navy kind of disappeared. So I came ashore, got a first degree, and then got a job in the offshore business, but discovered that the offshore business was the actual people who go offshore are absolutely magnificent professionals, but I seemed to get in with a company who were there to milk the business as opposed to add value.
Right.
So I kind of struggled with that for a while, and then I left and went to get another degree because that seemed to be the only way that I could distance myself in terms of my CV
right.
from the company that I had been working for. Got my master's at Cranfield, then went to join the Royal Navy as an instructor officer.
Okay.
And from there, I went to the submarine base in the Clyde, where I spent the next 6 years, I think, teaching people how to fire missiles.
Yeah, so it does say on your CV that you are a rocket scientist.
That's more kind of to draw the eye in. Yes, actually, I was.
I must say that I actually, an old friend of mine, he is a rocket scientist. He did work. He's from Belgium, and I said, "What do you used to do?" He said, "I used to build rockets."
Right.
I am a rocket scientist, and I thought, "Blimey, you're the only person that I've ever met that's had rocket scientists on their CV, and actually it being true."
Well, this is the thing is it's kind of long-winded to describe. Rocket scientist covers just about anyone who works with these systems. I worked with Polaris. I used to teach the weapons engineers how to fire these things, and then when we switched to Trident, I used to teach the weapons engineers on the submarines how to navigate them, which
right.
is essentially how to make them hit where you want them to hit.
Yes.
And this was I can't imagine anybody wanting to employ someone with that on the CV.
Well, perhaps not. So what have you been doing laterally? Because I know that you've written a couple of books on employee engagement, and that's sort of the reason, the rationale, the raison d'etre behind us having a conversation. So I mean, how did you get into the employee engagement sort of loop, as it were, or that sort of sphere, or develop an interest in that?
Well, it started off as something that I kind of discovered for myself, oddly enough, in the Navy, in the submarine school, because I was the officer in charge of the section, and the section comprised of 12 chiefs and a charge chief. And these chiefs were pretty talented individuals who had left school and gone straight into the Navy, and then had spent the next probably 8 or 10 years of their lives in full-time education on the weapons systems that we were teaching people to use.
Mm-hmm.
These were the most experienced, most trained, most educated, most astonishing people on this planet. And then I was put in an office next to them to be their boss.
Right.
With the understanding that the job of the boss was to tell them what to do.
Right.
And I sat there and I thought, how ludicrous, how absolutely silly for me, who has, my first exposure to the missile systems was my first day on the job.
Yes.
And they had been exposed to them practically sailing in the submarines and training for maybe 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
How on earth was I supposed to add any value by telling them what they already knew how to do?
Sure.
That has got to be, for them, the most insulting thing that it's possible to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked out, I figured out that my job should not really be to tell them what to do,
mm-hmm.
but to find out what they needed in order to do what they already knew how to do, and then get them for it.
Right.
Or get what they needed to do their jobs. So they didn't really believe this in the beginning, because they had spent their whole lives being told what to do by people who had no idea what it was they had to do.
Yeah, it's a command and control structure. It's almost like that's the culture.
And if you think about it, the Navy is the perfect place to find this structure.
Yes.
But to me, it just seemed so absolutely ludicrous in this situation. And what happened was that we became known as the barbecue section. Although we were teaching people to fire missiles, we were renowned for the fact that we were never in the office. We were always out having barbecues on Loch Lomond. And the reason for that was because I made it quite clear that they were the people who knew how to do the job.
Yes.
And if the job had been done, then I saw no need for them to sit at their desks pretending that they were working.
Yes.
Much better to do the job, and then when there was no job to be done, go.
Yes.
Have a barbecue. Or what happened an awful lot of the time was they would be out sailing or diving or climbing or something, making events for all the other sections in the base.
Sure. So
rather than being renowned for their professional expertise, they became renowned for having a good time. And in the process, were absolutely the best section on the base, because whatever they did, they took pride in doing their best at it. And when they finished, that was because they'd already done the job that was the best to the best of their ability.
So it's not about time served, it's about results achieved.
Exactly. We made this clear, they picked it up, they became... I don't know if they would have recognised or I would have recognised the term being engaged.
Yes.
But that's exactly what happened, is that by creating the environment where they became responsible for themselves,
yes,
they were able to take pride in what they did. And part of that pride, everyone said, oh, you can't tell them to go home. You'll never see them again. They'll be out playing golf. And the reality was, when there was nothing to be done professionally,
yes,
they were spending their time helping other people on the base to enjoy their own time that they had available. So if they were out sailing, there's a good chance that half the crew on the boat would be from other places around the base who didn't have the time to organise themselves.
Yes.
So the fact of them being allowed to engage has this knock on with all the rest of the base. And it was, I was going to say it was an absolute pleasure working with them, but it just never, ever seemed like work.
Well, I mean, it's an overused term in many ways, but it's almost like you just facilitated them in a way.
I think this is the idea. I think one of my stories ends with the words that the problem with management is that it was ever called management. If it had been called facilitation,
yes,
we would have had a completely different idea, a completely different expectation of what the facilitator, the manager, ought to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Because you're there to help people achieve things rather than just to cope in a way.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The problem with management is that managers want to manage.
Yes.
If they saw their job as being to facilitate, to help other people to achieve their potential, it would be completely different. It's just trying to find a snappy word you can call people who would do that. And to be fair, when when people first started to manage other people, that's exactly what they did. They told them what to do, because 100 years ago, you could fully expect that your workforce couldn't write or read or had no idea what it is they were actually doing. So there had to be command and control strategy, because there was no other way to get that sort of worker to create what was necessary.
So actually, in a way, the if you like, the foundation of management as it was originally conceived or developed has been undermined by the development of education and literacy of the workforce.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. That the command and the control, which if you think about the first people who were ever managed, yeah, were the military.
Yes.
And in the military, you had to do what you were told, or you would get shot.
Well, yes, because it's like you're all there to protect each other in a way.
Yeah, and what managers seem to be looking for today is the same sort of ultimate threat which will allow them to tell their workforces what to do. The problem is that the workforce today is, even the military today,
mm-hmm,
are so educated,
mm-hmm,
so experienced, so imaginative, so creative, that they react very badly when someone else makes the assumption that they know so much more, they can tell them what to do. It's a kind of arrogance.
Well, it's almost like they're threatened by initiative in a way.
It is, because if you look at it, if you have a somebody in, say take the missile school where I was,
yeah,
in my position, a traditional naval officer would not have been able to listen to what his section wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the Navy, you are told that you are absolutely wonderful.
Yes.
You have been touched by God. That's why you're in the position. That's why you've got gold on your sleeves. That's why you're in that position.
Yes.
And
so it's almost a bit, it becomes like a right rather than a privilege.
Yeah, it's kind of, this is the sort of arrogance you have to assume, because in order to lead, you have to have this arrogance.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the days when our workforce was this semi-literate bunch of people with very limited experience and very limited understanding of their social world.
Yes.
Everybody lived in tiny little cells, if you like, and they were completely beholden to the people who employed them. I mean, if you worked on somebody's estate, you couldn't just say, oh, I'm fed up working here, I'm going to work next door, because the guy next door was actually related to the guy who you just quit.
Yes, indeed.
And along with the job came the house,
mm-hmm,
and all sorts of things that allowed your family to live. So you, there was no social mobility, because if you tried to move around, then that's it. You know, he quit from me, don't give him a job, and that's it. And there's no social security. You're in the poorhouse if you're lucky. If not, you just starve. And it was those sort of people and those sorts of relationships that created this command and control hierarchy in the military, which worked while it was still the people who did the job at the bottom and the people who owned the job at the top.
Yeah.
The problem comes, obviously, when we go through a couple of wars and all the people who said, follow me, were the first people to get shot.
Yes.
And all the people who followed them were the second people to get shot.
Yeah.
So we end up in a period where the landowners can no longer manage the land. And for landowners, you read factory owners as well, because they, yeah, were the same people.
Uh-huh.
They can no longer manage their businesses because they haven't got the children to pass them on to.
Yes.
They've run out of people, and the people who used to plough the land and used to man the factories have all been shot as well. So suddenly, instead of them being beholden to the landowners and the factory owners for their jobs and their lives, they suddenly discover that they're actually valuable commodities.
Mm-hmm.
And they can now be mobile, and they can go from one to the other saying, well, you said you'd give me £5 a year. Your mate over there said he'd give me £6, so I'll tell you what, I'm going there. And because the whole system is falling to pieces, you can do that.
Yeah.
So suddenly we've got choice, and suddenly people are growing into the fact that they have an intrinsic value. And where that value is not appreciated, they can move on.
So in following on from the Navy and everything, I mean, and you've written some couple of books on this sort of stuff, and it's more about stories and things. Yeah. I mean, you must have worked with other firms that are and helped them achieve some of the things and develop the people that their people in a way that it moves away from command and control management more to facilitation, to which allows them to develop a more engaged and, you know, more productive sort of team. Can you tell us a couple of stories or give us a couple of examples of firms, different firms that you've experienced, that you've seen that are doing things, if you like, doing the right things and doing things well, and what are they doing?
Well, we should go back to, I mean, everything goes back to the Navy because it was weird. It was when I left the Navy, because as an instructor, I had an 8-year commission, and after 8 years, I left.
Okay.
Well, that's one way of putting it. They didn't want me anymore is another way of putting it.
You've come too expensive, probably.
or possibly too irritating.
Well.
In a situation where the whole hierarchy runs on command and control.
Yeah.
It's very annoying to discover someone like me whose military section consistently outperforms everyone else. But as far as they're concerned, I'm not doing the right thing, which is shouting at people and telling them what to do. And from that point of view, I think that the establishment felt very undermined that I'm able to do everything that I did without actually any of the management tools that they thought were absolutely indispensable for a good naval officer, which was arrogance and all of the sort of characteristics that make for poor managers, which at the time they thought were absolutely essential characteristics for an officer.
Well, let me ask you a question then, based on that, because I think there's an interesting, if you like, angle on this, and it's more about change and culture change, and where does it and where can it start? A lot of people say that culture change has to start from the top, as it were, and become top down. But I've always had a belief that it can also start in a slightly more guerrilla way, from the bottom and via sort of small teams and small departments, and then it's almost about influence in a way and getting noticed. And although when you're in an establishment or an organization or a culture like the Navy, I guess that's going to be hard because it's so ingrained. They decide to shuffle you out and go, oh, upstarts, we'll get rid of them and go back to the way we were. But do you believe that culture change can start at both the top and the bottom?
It's kind of tricky. First off, if anything starts from the top,
yes,
then it's got to be traditional command and control.
Yes. Which
is that the people who are in command are trying to exert their control by making the workforce do something.
Mm-hmm.
That has never worked.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a shame that people still waste so much energy trying to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
They assume that, oh, maybe I'm just doing something wrong. What is wrong is just trying to make other people do stuff.
Yeah.
That creates the resistance that prevents them from doing stuff. It's a catch-22. It's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of culture change, what I think we mean by that is that we've got a lazy, shiftless, unimaginative, tardy workforce,
mm-hmm,
who just will not do anything that we tell them to. We want to change their culture to make them do what we tell them to.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're trying to do by command and control is to make them into someone who responds to command and control.
Right.
Right? But let's look at what the workforce actually is today.
Mm-hmm.
They're all educated.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are educated to the same or above the levels of their manager.
Yeah.
They're all experienced. They have massive amounts of experience. If you take 200 people and you've got one manager,
mm-hmm,
how outrageous is it for the manager to assume that he can tell them what to do based on the fact you've got 200 lifetimes of experience. It's like me in the Navy. It's a ridiculous situation. Let's assume that the natural culture of the workforce, every single individual, I'm sure it would take some time, but if you went around the world and you asked 6 billion people, are you an individual?
Yes.
They would probably all say yes, because we are.
Yes.
If we start treating these individuals as if they're idiots, there's a guy called Goethe, mid-18th century, I think.
Yeah.
Goethe said that if we treat people the way we think they ought to be, that is what they will become. What we have got in our workforce is a bunch of independent, imaginative, energetic, creative people.
Yeah.
If we treat them as if they are idiots, if we treat them as if they have no value, then they will start to behave as if they have no value. So when people talk about culture change, what they normally talk about is how can we get these people who have no value to be valuable? What is it that we have to do? And if we think about what Goethe said, what Goethe says is that if we start treating them as if they are valuable, that's what they will become. Because individually, they are all valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have a workforce that we assume have no intrinsic value, then they will not give us that value. It's like people have this thing, discretionary effort, and they can either turn up for work, spend all day at work, and then get their pay, or they can turn up at work and think how they can do what they do better. And we want a workforce made up of the latter. What we don't, or what most managers don't seem to get, is the fact that the workforce actually want to be the latter. We're trying to force onto them in a traditional way a culture that will make them change. The reality is that the culture that we want is actually already present.
We just have to let it emerge.
Exactly. People turn up at work, they don't want to do a bad job.
Yes.
They want to turn up and be proud of what they do. They want to use their experience, their imagination, their education in order to make something that they are proud of. And that is the culture that actually we want as well.
So I actually kind of, in a really sort of, if you like, very basic sort of level, people don't want to be unhappy.
Exactly. If you look at the way that people behave at work,
yes,
it's completely different to the way they behave when they leave work, because when they leave work, they're part of the little league. They might be in amateur dramatics. They might support the local theatre. They might do all sorts of things.
Yes,
but that is their discretionary effort. They give themselves willingly their time and their effort and their energy to things because they choose to.
Yes.
But when they come into work, then they switch off that discretionary effort, because even no matter how much they do, they will never have that effort recognized. I remember standing next to the manager of a shipyard in Clyde Bank, and he was, and it was a social visit, so I could be quite abusive to him if I wanted to.
Okay.
But as we were standing looking out of his window, and we were looking at his workforce coming in on Monday morning, his comment to me was, "Look at them. How am I expected to build ships with people like that?" And to a man, as they came in, their heads were down. There was nobody whistling. They were just a completely miserable bunch of people. And I just had to say, can't you see that it's the environment that has been created for them that is making them like that? Because all of these people, when they leave this shipyard, They're going off to watch Celtic or Rangers. They're going off to play football. They're going off to do whatever they want. They go away and they smile about what they're doing.
Sure.
Because they choose where to put that discretionary effort. And what we're looking at here is that they want to be happy. They want to be in a situation where they can be proud of what they do.
Yeah.
But the way that their managers, their supervisors behave towards them at work prevents that from happening.
I think there's an important point, the thing that's just occurred to me, is that when people come to that realization and then start to try and make this sort of change, the changes, the thing that can happen is that people then say, well, we're starting to be a different way, but we're not really seeing the results, kind of, as it were. And I think it's important to note that actually, if you've been working for 10, 5, 10, 15, 20 years or whatever, and then your environment changes, you're not necessarily going to change overnight, because you've got to learn to sort of trust and respect and also believe and in a way sort of rediscover the initiative and the belief and the desire to want to do more for yourselves as well. So it's a bit like sort of almost like going to Battersea Dogs Home and adopting a dog that's been abused. And you think, well, actually, if you take it home, the dog's got to learn to trust you.
You're absolutely right. This our behavior is, as Pavlov points out, is the sum of all our experiences.
Absolutely. And
if, as a member of the workforce, we have been mistreated by management
at any point in the past,
or continuously for 10 or 15 years, which is probably more likely,
yes,
then it takes time and it takes repeated exposure to the right behavior for us to begin to trust. But the behavior, the people whose behavior needs to change, is the manager. And I'll tell you, there was an absolutely brilliant story I saw when I was working in South America. And in South America, there is no question about what management strategy is called. It's just, you do what I say or you can sling your hook. There is no subtlety about it at all.
Sure.
And I was on a rig in the middle of the jungle, and the crews used to do 12-hour shifts, and it used to take them 3 hours traveling through the jungle to get to the rig. So, you know, we're talking about an 18-hour day here. And these guys, when they travel along these bumpy roads in a Dodge minivan, which had seating for 18 people. And the absolute minimum that ever came on that bus was 19 people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the driver's seat, and then there's a comfy seat next to it. And in the back, there's just two long benches with hard wooden slats.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are sitting on those for 3 hours, through these bumpy roads. And I used to watch them getting out of the bus, and they used to spend ages stretching and moving, just trying to get their limbs working again, get the blood flowing. And I told these guys when I first arrived at the rig that the reason I was here was I was looking for ways to do their job better, to make things that were just better. I was avoiding the use of performance improvement and all this nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
These were jungle Indians.
Yeah.
Better, they understood. And this guy, Raul, who's an assistant driller, came up to me after, it was probably the day after I arrived. And he said, you know, was it right that you want our ideas on how we can make things better? And I said, that's right. You tell me what you need, and I will do my best to get it. And he started off talking about all sorts of things about the bus, the length of the journey, how some people had to walk an hour to get to the bus sometimes. And it was just like an outflowing, because nobody had ever listened to him before.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got to his point, which, you know, was, what do you actually want, Raul? He said, well, I just want some cushions. I just want some cushions for the back seat. And I said, right, I'll see what I can do. And I went to the rig manager, and I said, you know, I've got this idea. And you remember when I first came here, I asked you that if I came to you with an idea from the workforce, you just did your best to try and make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if you couldn't, then that's fine. But I want to know the reason why not, because mm-hmm. I'm going to take that reason back to the person who brought me the idea, because that's going to change the way they feel about what they do.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to this guy and I thought, this is a brilliant conversation. I wish I wasn't having it. I wish I was watching it, because it's going to be really good. And I said to this guy, he was a German,
mm-hmm.
he was called Willy Schmidt. How he arrived in South America and when he arrived, I had no idea, but he'd been there some time. And I said to Willy, look, I've got an idea from one of the members of the crew, and he's asked me if he could get some cushions on the bus. And you can imagine this guy. He's been managing rigs for 10 or 15 years. And he just kind of went purple and started going, cushions on the bus, cushions on the bus. Imagine this with a Spanish-German accent. On the bus. And he was going, you know, what do they think? They think this is a holiday camp. This is an oil rig. We're in the middle of the jungle. What do they want next, a swimming pool? And I was sort of going, yeah, okay. And let him wind himself down a bit. And at the end of it, I said, so what sort of ideas do you want from the crew? Do you want ideas that are going to save them $10,000 a week in drilling costs? Is that the sort of thing you want? Yes, of course it is. I'm not running a holiday camp. That's the sort of idea I want. So I said, well, just suppose that whoever's come up with this idea of cushions on the bus, just suppose that he has got a $10,000 a week idea. If he doesn't get cushions on the bus, do you think he's going to give you that $10,000 idea?
Yeah.
And Willie just sort of stood there, and I could see all the, you know, it's like Babbage's computer, all the little cogs and things turning in his head. And he said, what color cushions do you think I should get?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you've got it.
Yeah.
Now you're beginning to get it. Exactly what you said earlier, Adrian, is that it's the result. Our behavior is the result of repeated experience.
Yeah.
If he didn't get cushions, then that was the last idea we would get out of him.
Mm-hmm.
If he did get cushions, that changes the way he feels about what he does. And now he's actively looking for other ideas. And sometimes he'll find that $10,000 idea.
Absolutely. So, Peter, I guess my question would be, given all your experience, and if I think about managers and leaders, and there's two things that happens. One is that somebody will say that's about a mind shift change, and when you could do it, but that's a very personal sort of decision. You make that decision, and then it's like you're embarking on a different way of doing things. But I guess one of the things that people might say is that, well, if I get that, so that's fine. What would you say would be, where should I start? What's the first thing I should start doing? Is it just, you should just go and talk to people and listen to them and just try and help?
Well, yes.
Okay, thank you. There you go, that's a good answer.
But the problem is that you have to do it in a very structured way.
Yeah.
Because as human beings, we're absolutely rubbish at doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are very good at, should we call it, working the crowd?
Yes.
And these people are undoubtedly talented, and it is something that is inherent in the way that they work. For most managers, I would say for almost all managers that I've ever met,
mm-hmm.
that it is something that is very alien. And it's very easy for managers to make excuses not to do this. Come on, there's 300 people on the shop floor. Am I expected to go and shake hands and know that everybody's family history and what their problems are and make personal relationships? No, it's nothing about that. It's about putting a process in place that allows each one of those to have a voice,
mm-hmm.
and to be listened to. And it's something that there's I have this idea that if it's not something that you can do to make a difference on Monday morning, then it's just nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
People are so happy to spout little homilies about the way we ought to behave and stuff like that. But what you need is, what do I do on Monday morning?
Yes.
And on Monday morning, you go in and you get a meeting with a bunch of people who tend to work together or more or less in the same place. And you say to them, what have you just done? What went well? What went badly?
Mm-hmm.
What can we do to ensure that things continue going well? What can we do to avoid things going badly next time?
Mm-hmm.
The answers to those questions are the ideas, the ways to make change, the ways to make the process or the service or whatever it is better. Some of them have a financial impact.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have a safety impact. Some of them, we're not sure about the impact. But whatever the money side of it, every single idea has an impact on the way that people feel about what they do. Because if you have an idea and somebody says, that's brilliant, we're going to do that, you walk away from that thinking, wow, that was my idea.
And yeah.
There is no amount of money on this planet will buy the way that that makes people feel. And it's that feeling that turns into engagement.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think the one thing I'd also say is that I've had experience with people that they've gone and tried to do this, and then they turn around and they go, oh, well, we did that and asked them and nobody said anything. And therefore, we thought it was a rubbish idea and then we stopped doing it. And I thought, well, actually, again, it's you've got to think about the learned experience side of things. And it reminds me of an old a saying that I love back from Woody Allen, which says 80% of success is showing up.
Well, yeah.
And I think that there's the idea of, like, if you believe in asking and helping and making things better, then you've got to keep showing up and you've got to commit to it, because actually by committing to it, you're showing people that this is important.
Exactly. If you go in on Monday morning and you have that meeting and you get ideas from people, you've got to have another meeting the next Monday morning.
Yeah.
To tell them, to give them the feedback.
Yeah.
Because it's that feedback which is absolutely key. Tells them that they are being listened to.
Indeed.
That they're being valued. And as Goethe said, when they know they're being valued, they become valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So that the following Monday, when you have that meeting again, then they're prepared and they're bringing even more ideas and more ways of working that will produce more profit, make the whole organization more efficient, because they are being allowed to have a voice. And it's that voice. It's we don't tell them you've got to bring ideas. It's like sticking a suggestion box up on the wall and you put big letters on it which says suggestion box.
Yeah.
And then you have a meeting to explain to people what a suggestion box is for. They know.
Exactly. But
the reason that they will use it is if they get feedback. And if we start this dialogue with them, we don't have to know them or know what they're about or have any complicated relationships. We just need them to know that we are listening to their ideas and we're either going to do it, in which case the answer is yes, or we're not going to do it, but we'll tell them the reason why not.
Yeah.
That is just as good feedback as no, because you're giving them feedback which says, no, we're not going to do it, but here's the reason why not.
Mm-hmm.
The chances are that feedback is stuff that they've never had before.
Sure.
And they don't know the reason why not. So they go, oh, I never knew that. Right. And then the following Monday, they're back at the meeting and saying, right, now I know this. Now it will work because if we do this, this, and this, it'll avoid the problem that you... Wow, that's brilliant. Now it does work. Thank you. That's spot on. Next week, I will tell you exactly when it is we're going to start that new process. And so... Exactly as I said, with Pavlov, it's about a repeated experience.
Yeah.
The thing about engagement is that it's like pushing a snowball uphill.
Uh-huh.
You've got to keep managing it and keep it going in the right direction. Because if you take your eye off the ball, it'll be rolling back down behind you, and you will lose all the ground you've made up.
Well, yeah, because people are just going to make assumptions that if you stop doing things and that you think it becomes another fad, you don't care about it, and you don't care about them, and so why would they continue to care about you?
Right. And when you're talking about in that way, think about caring and think about relationships that we have. Think about feelings, right? We're trying to change the way the workforce feel about what they do.
Yes.
Other things, you know, people say, oh, right, we'll have a survey. Think about other sorts of feelings that we have a lot of, mm-hmm. right? Love, happiness, hate, jealousy, all these things. Do we have any surveys? I mean, before you got married, did you actually have your wife fill in a questionnaire to discover how much she loved you? I think not.
Exactly. I hate surveys.
Engagement is a feeling in the same way that love is, right? Mm-hmm. If during our courtship we were suddenly late mm-hmm. for a date, or we started swearing like a trooper, or we picked our nose during a romantic dinner, then these are things which would turn off the love which was growing.
Yes.
Right? But would it make any difference if somebody filled in a questionnaire to say, does your husband pick his nose at dinner? It makes no sense.
Yeah, no, indeed. Indeed.
We can't measure. That is an intangible in the same way that these other feelings are intangibles. We can't measure them, but we know when we've got them.
Yeah, so it's not an outcome in and of itself. It's
no, the outcome, the measurable outcome, is the environment that we create, right? We create an environment for our prospective wife. She becomes a part of that environment. Mm-hmm. And as a result of the environment that we've created, she falls in love with us or not.
I think the ultimate measurement is the results that it produces.
Well, this is, you know, people keep saying, well, you've got to measure something. The way I look at it is that if you talk to an accountant, their idea of measurable improvement is 4, 5, 6%, something, you know, it's like a single figure improvement.
Yeah.
They can go to the shareholders meeting and say, yeah, 7.5% over the last year's whoopee-doo, we're doing fine.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Covey, he quotes a figure of 500% performance improvement if your workforce is allowed to engage.
Mm-hmm.
500% sounds astonishing,
mm-hmm.
except that I know people who agree with that sort of figure.
Mm-hmm.
I personally find that a bit low, but I am perfectly aware that if you start making really big numbers, there's just no way that anyone will believe you. So let's stick with Stephen Covey. He's talking about this, the value of the discretionary effort of the workforce being of the order of 500%. And I'll go with that.
Mm-hmm.
This is because we don't force onto them the behaviors that we want. We create the environment that then allows the workforce to choose to behave in that way.
Sure.
It's like nobody was ever forced to love anyone. I mean, we know how ridiculous that is. You can't do that. If you try and force one person to love another, you will create the resistance that prevents that from happening.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, absolutely true. And Peter, I'm just kind of looking at, I'm conscious of time and things, and just thinking
okay,
that,
right.
No, it's just fine. I thought, let's kind of try and wrap this, you know, start to think about wrapping this up. And there's a couple of things a couple of questions that I normally finish these interviews on. And that is there anything or any sort of top tips or top advice that you would give to people or things to think about on the back of this kind of conversation? Is there any highlights or anything that we've missed? Do you think, actually, if you're going to do anything, do this?
The first thing has got to be, if you don't change something that you do, you'll continue to get what you've always got.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
And stop telling people what to do. Find out what they need instead.
Mm-hmm.
and try your best to give it to them.
Perfect.
Yeah. Perfect. Doing that changes the way that they feel about what they do, allows them to start to think, I'm going to give this person my discretionary effort. Discretionary effort is worth so much. And the Stephen Covey book, by the way, is Principle-Centered Leadership. I knew that would come eventually.
There you go. Got the reference. I'll make sure I get that linked up. So, Peter, my final question that I always end these interviews on is this. Is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Well, clearly, my book, which is published, I think next week, is The Problem with Management and How to Solve It.
Fantastic. And
this is, it's subtitled The Engagement Handbook. Principally because I have been in this, the business of trying to get people to understand how easy it is to engage their workforces. But there is almost a whole industry, an engagement industry, which runs around surveys and questionnaires and training courses and stuff, all of which demonstrates a complete lack of understanding about what engagement is.
Yeah.
And in the stories in this book, we can see what engagement is, what effect it has, what happens when people aren't allowed to disengage, what happens when they are, how much it's worth, how much disengagement costs. It's, if you want to know anything about engagement, how to do it or what it is, then this book, the stories in this book, allow the reader to find these things out. And because I say, stop telling people what to do, then at no time do I ever tell anyone what engagement is.
Fine.
Why would I expect that to work?
Well, it's a bit like turning around to somebody and saying, what is love?
But if I told you a love story, you would know what it was.
But I'd know what it meant for me, and not necessarily, it wouldn't necessarily have the same meaning for you or for another person.
Exactly. And who is it important? Is it important what I think, or is it important what you think and know?
Exactly. Exactly right.
These are stories about not what I think about engagement. These are stories about what happened to people and what they thought and what happened to them as a result of an aspect of engagement. So, like, we could have a book full of love stories, which people enjoy for their own sake. Here we've got a book full of engagement stories, which people can enjoy for their own sake, but they can also learn from, to either confirm what they knew already, or perhaps just to sow a seed that, maybe that's something that I could try.
Sure. Peter, that's been brilliant, and thank you for that, and I'll make sure I get all that edited up and linked up, and give everybody a bit, give the book a big sort of shout out. Mm-hmm. And so just thank you again for your time today.
My absolute pleasure, Adrian. I just hope that there's not too much to edit out.
I'm sure it'll be fine.
Apart from that bit.